Philip Graffin playing Brahms, the Hungarian Dance No. 7, arranged by Josef Joachim, with Claire Deser at the piano. Well, that's just about it for this morning's programme. Next week, I've a new book as my prompt, Forbidden Music by Michael Haas, which deals with composers who were banned by the Nazis. Between 10 and 11, I'll be playing some of their works, from Offenbach to Kurt Weill, from Korngold to Victor Ullmann. So please do join me next Sunday, same time, 9 o'clock.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this morning by Neil Miners.
The climax of Radio 3's week of Wagner.
Opera on 3.
A live performance of Lohengrin from Welsh National Opera. Peter Wedd, Susan Bickley and Emma Bell lead the cast in a tale of chivalry and redemption. Broadcast live on BBC Radio 3 from the Wales Millennium Centre in Cardiff. And alongside the opera during the interval, a Radio 3 music guide to Lohengrin.
This afternoon at 2:45.
Well, now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Bruce Munro is a highly successful lighting designer. He creates light art installations. Last year had great success with his debut exhibition in America. He's currently at Waddesdon Manor with Cantus Articus, inspired by the Finnish composer Rautavaara. And that suggests, Bruce, that music's rather important to you.
It's always been important to me, but I think in the last 5 to 10 years it's become part of my work. It was something I always wished to involve with my light work, and I've been fortunate.
You said lighting sets the mood and stirs emotions and can transform the subconscious feeling of a space entirely. And looking at them, quite often, it's like a row of light flowers almost. And then in another one, there's like a shower of rain, but in fact it's a shower of tiny lights. Would you like to give some examples?
My inspiration and using light in this way came to me in my 40s, soon after my father died. I suddenly decided that I wanted to really try and create pieces of work that I'd often dreamt about creating. And I then decided that my subject matter had to be something very important if it was going to be worthy of the time spent doing that kind of thing. So when Dad died, I really started thinking about moments of clarity, very, very small moments of time when I sort of dissolved into those moments and felt connected with the world. And I really wanted to try and express these feelings in some way. I didn't know how, and because I was working with light and I was familiar with light as a medium, I just came up with these ideas and they evolved.
How did you become familiar with light? What were you doing that took you in that path?
Well, I did the normal art school route. I'd always loved art, painting and drawing from a young age. And I travelled over to Australia just by chance on a working holiday, and I ended up doing lots of jobs. And I happened to walk past a shop window one day. It was a display window. And I saw these light products in the window that were glowing, and I kept on doing a bit of a Harry Worth, sort of walking past the window, stopping and going and have a look. One day I was going to work, walked into the shop and found out where they came from, and it was luckily they were imported into Sydney. So I bought a whole load and started making sculptures in my flat.
Because when I said at the beginning lighting designer, that'll always probably mean to people that you light shows or that you light opera. I mean, it's very different from that. You're an artist working with light, really.
Yes, I did actually, because I've got 4 children and a family to support. I had to start off earning a living, and I started off lighting houses and gardens. In fact, prior to that, I was making objects, and I had quite a commercial background to start with after my fine art studies. So I learned quite a lot about manufacturing techniques and the way to organise yourself, and then the opportunity to be more creative. It's been a 30-year journey, so it hasn't just happened.
We're going back even more than 30 years, actually, because we're going to your prep school, aren't we, for the first music?
Yes. I discovered classical music when I first went to prep school, and I couldn't read music very well, but I could sing. I loved singing. I joined the choir, and then I joined a choral society. And the fun of a choral society was that you could stay up late at school, anything to sort of do something different from the rules. And I just was amazed at how powerful a group of people could be. You know, we had teachers singing with us, and boys, obviously I was probably singing a treble then or an alto, and it was just very moving. And you didn't have to know what the words were, the music just moved your spirit.
And this was one of the pieces you sang?
Yes.
Mozart Ave Verum.
Yes.
The curious thing, hearing that music, is that when I was young and a chorister, and I sang it so many times, and it had a kind of rather hackneyed feel for me then. And hearing it again now, after quite a gap, I mean, I must have heard it in the meantime, I suddenly see the beauty in it, in a way
I had somehow slightly erased. Isn't it funny how memory can do that?
Yes, very much so. Just listening then, I totally agree with you. It's quite emotional when you do, takes you back to places. But I think it was the innocence of the sound when you were first singing. You were really singing to the heavens. There was an energy there that when you become older and more cynical, you don't have that same connection.
Ave Verum Corpus, Kirkle 618 by Mozart. The choir of St John's College, Cambridge, directed by George Guest. I was very amused to discover, Bruce Munro, that when you moved on into sort of studenthood, I think you had just a couple of LPs, didn't you, or a collection, and they couldn't have been more contrasting.
Yes. Well, I acquired my first stereo late on in life. I was 21. I had a student grant, and you always feel flush at the beginning of term, so I went into the music shop in Bristol, and I could see immediately that I was only going to be able to afford two or three cassettes in those days at the most. And then I saw this bargain basement, Beethoven's Nine Symphonies, all for the sort of price of one piece. So I looked at it and I thought, well, I do like Beethoven. I didn't know, I mean, I can remember listening to bits of it at school and thought, well, at least I won't get bored. And there was hours and hours of it. So I bought that and I bought the Police as well.
Both very good in their different ways.
Yes, wonderful.
Which symphony would you like to home in on?
The first movement of the Fifth Symphony. When we listen to classical music, we should be jumping around to it. I remember my grandfather used to conduct to me when he was listening to his gramophone. He used to really let go in quite a sort of wonderful way. And I just thought, well, I should be doing this, but somehow involving light with it.
And I think in much the same way, when you had your freedom, as it were, in your flat, because I think your flatmate might have been away.
Yes.
And you would put on your music, perhaps quaff a can of special brew.
Yes.
And then you felt liberated as an artist, is that right? You kind of just rejoiced in the ability to paint.
It was the first time in my life that I had that sense of freedom, real freedom. And you're quite right. I used to move all the furniture, pin sheets of paper to the wall. I was doing a lot of work on paper then, and splash paint around and spend the whole weekend doing it. And then before my flatmate came back, move everything back. I actually used to have a tin of white emulsion that I would repaint the walls where I'd gone over.
So that was probably the visual counterpart of dancing to this music we're going to hear now.
Very much so, yes. Thank you.
Very muscular music.
Yes.
That was the first movement of the Symphony No. 5 in C minor, Opus 67 by Beethoven, the Tonhalle Orchestra of Zurich, directed by David Zinman. Bruce Munro, I think probably one of the pieces that really helped to make your name was Field of Light. And that had sort of 6,000 acrylic stems, didn't it, topped by clear glass and with fibre optics inside.
That's right. The first one we created was in my field at home, and that had 15,000 stems. We've actually done a number of installations.
The Eden Project, didn't you?
The Eden Project, you're quite correct. That was, I think, the second one I did. That was around about 6,000.
And since we're listening to CDs, perhaps you'd tell me a little bit about CDC.
CDC was, I remember I had this wonderful moment sitting by the sea in Sydney Harbour one Sunday afternoon. It was a lovely sunny afternoon when the light is that silvery blinding light on a ruffled sea. And my mood was slightly down in the dumps, and it transformed from being down in the dumps to one of at one with the world. Anyway, years later, I was thinking about subject matter. And I thought, oh, I'd like to create a sea. How do I do it? And the idea just popped into my head that a CD is essentially a large sequin. And if you put enough of them on the ground closely together, you will get something that is close to a shimmering sea. Well, so I thought. So I thought about it, and then I thought, well, this is going to work. And it's difficult to test that out without doing it. But I put a call out for a million CDs because I worked out a million was the area of our field.
How did you get a million CDs, if
well,
I might ask?
Very kindly, some magazines were doing some writing on my work. They put some ads out. We advertised ourselves, and we got a fantastic response. People from all over the world just sending. I mean, I would literally get packets of CDs. And what made me feel guilty was that sometimes the postage was more expensive than the CDs. I mean, we had things from Argentina, we had stuff from the Vatican. You would be amazed. And we also, when we had a shortfall, we went to a local recycling centre and we borrowed quite a lot from them to put down in the field.
Actually, it was down in the dumps, working in a swimming pool when you were quite young. I think you had to clean it for one of your jobs.
Yes.
And that the combination of music and light, which informs the next piece, transformed your mood yet again.
Yes, I was 21. I was in the middle of my degree and I had a summer job. My father lived down in Salcombe in Devon. And yes, I was a swimming pool attendant. And I used to clean the pool before everybody got in. And it was a rather nasty job cleaning off the scum line with chlorine crystals. And I used to put on Rodrigo's guitar concerto.
Thank you. We heard the first movement of the Concierto de Aranjuez by Rodrigo. Narciso Yepes was the guitarist with the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by García Navarro. You've got an ongoing relationship with Waddesdon, but just tell me what this looked like when you'd finished it. As we listen to this music, what should we be imagining?
Well, again, interestingly, we made a small film of the installation, and the person who was editing it, a friend of mine called Ian Ellaby, he then put in the titles. And I realised that my interpretation was nothing, probably, like the vision that the composer had. And so I was thinking, oh, thank goodness I didn't read the words, because I saw this as basically going through a day, a night, and coming through to morning again. And the three movements are, for me, the one we're about to hear is sort of twilight. And what we've created is an abstraction. I listened to the birds, and the birds gave me a form in my head. And the form had to be very simple. And then obviously I was thinking of the northern climes. So I was thinking of the Aurora Borealis. And I was trying to combine several things at once, but very simply. And it's really an experience to lose yourself in the installation. We've used some mirror to increase the space, and used colour to evoke a time of day.
Melancholy from Cantus Articus, Opus 61 by Rautavaara, the Lahti Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Osmo Vanska. While that was playing, Bruce Munro, you said something that's so interesting. I'd like to explore it again, which is you're saying how that in many ways the eye is more limited than the ear. And so you were using various controls to graduate the light.
Yes. I think what's exciting is that this is a learning curve. Everything's a learning curve. And what I noticed when we were programming the music to the light, that we just didn't have that control between a glimmer of light and a lot of light, whereas difficult to see that visually, and also changing hue. And in my mind's eye, obviously, when I was thinking all this up, I was thinking I'm going to have it just like this, and I could really see it. And when it got to the actual programming, I realised the limitations. But it doesn't matter, because you learn. And the lovely thing about installations is working in the present, because you have to react to the present and you have to make adjustments, and you might abstract it in a different way to how you preconceived it.
So there, would you bring up the kind of glow, as it were, the red glow, as that piece was progressing?
Yes, my dilemma in that, because actually it goes into another piece, which is night and when the aurora borealis starts moving, and I thoroughly recommend listening to the piece of music. I really wanted to think, how do I turn from red to black red, which you could do with paint, and then from black red to having waves of the northern lights, which is a sort of phosphorescence green and pinks, and you just don't have blacks in light, so you've got to forget that. It's frustrating.
I hadn't thought of that, yes.
Yeah, no, you can't do it. And in a way, it doesn't matter, because I think that's where one becomes too literal. The lovely thing about the installation for me was that the shapes were very simple. I thought, how does a child draw a bird? And we've all drawn seagulls. So the basis, structural basis of the installation is childlike seagulls, but put into a pattern where it becomes an abstract pattern.
Tell me about your ambitions to be a bishop, Bruce Munro.
When I was very young, I, you know, like all children, you don't know what you're going to do. I was the youngest of three, and I went through a stage, probably when I was singing in the choir, that I thought it would be nice to be a bishop. I think I quite liked the clothes they used to wear. I thought
that mitre.
And I was going to be a bishop, and I was going to be a diplomat, and my parents were roaring with laughter because I was, well, I just wasn't qualified for either. Yeah.
But it was about that time, I think, that with your voice changing,
yes,
that you sang this next music.
Yes, this is my one and only chance to sing a solo. And I have to say, I'd sung this piece of music so many times as a prep school chorister, and then I was in my senior school. Just luckily, I wasn't put off by my voice not breaking at that age. I think 6 months later, I was embarrassed to sing that high. And of course, I wanted to sing a tenor or alto.
And it is?
It's Lead Me, Lord, in Thy Righteousness, from Praise the Lord, O My Soul, by Samuel Wesley.
There was a look of relief on your face, Bruce Munro, as the high note in that piece was achieved.
Yes, it brings back memories. And I think I could only start enjoying singing that, probably 10 bars from the end, because I remember it was very hard, and just hitting it. And there was that sense of, phew, I've done that.
Lead me, Lord, in thy righteousness, from Praise the Lord, O My Soul, by Wesley. And we heard the choir of Worcester Cathedral. Stephen Shellard was the alto soloist, Donald Hunt directed, and Adrian Partington played the organ. Something now which takes us on to the stage, Bruce, and I think probably there's a strong family connection here. Your mother.
Yes, my mother used to play Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet a lot, and it was one of her favourite pieces. And there's a particular piece called Morning Serenade. I'm very optimistic as a person, and it just reminds me of spring, sunshine, gardens, and particularly a sort of link with sound and music. It's the mark making of, if you look at some of Van Gogh's drawings or David Hockney's mark making, they are very musical. And I've often been intrigued to think, how can I translate some of this music to light? And I have a number of ideas.
Interesting the way the mandolin gives that a delicate sort of sparkle.
Yes, it's just a very beautiful piece. And as I said, it reminds me of spring, and it reminds me of those little musical boxes. There's something very sort of mechanical about it.
Just little twirling figures.
Yes, yeah.
And in fact, that's inspired you to do a piece, hasn't it, with lights and glass? And...
Yes, music is very evocative about materials and atmospheres, and so it gives me inspiration.
Well, we heard Morning Serenade there from Romeo and Juliet, Act 3, Opus 64 by Prokofiev, played by the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andre Previn. The extraordinary thing about the film 2001, Bruce, was that I remember when we first saw it, It seemed light years ahead, to use an appropriate metaphor. And, of course, now the date 2001 is long past. But nevertheless, the concept, the marriage of music and movement and infinity somehow, was a stroke of genius in that, wasn't it?
Yes, it's over 40 years old now, plus. It was 1968 when the film came out. It was Stanley Kubrick's masterpiece. I saw the film probably in my teens, and I was just blown away by the use of a piece of classical music to something that was so contemporary and, you know, spaceships, this huge revolving drum. And the tempo was brilliant with that sort of slowness of moving in space.
It was the Blue Danube by Strauss. And it had a kind of eerie effect, didn't it? That idea that something was sort of floating and turning in space. And this dance, because afterwards dance music that accompanied.
Yes, the music has helped keep the film young and contemporary. If they had put some electronic music of the 70s, it would be so dated.
And it conjures up, when you hear it, immediately that image, doesn't it?
Floating above the Earth, to see the Earth from another vantage point. And it is beautiful. It is a blue globe spinning slowly in a black sky. And it was a year before the moon landings, which is, yeah, incredible.
Herbert von Karajan conducted the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra in The Blue Danube, Opus 314, by Johann Strauss. Bruce, from what you were saying, it's very clear that music's going to go on being a sort of inspirational aspect of your work.
Yes, I think it will be. It's taken me long enough to get to the point of being able to use it in my work or involve it in my work. And I feel my foot's just on the bottom rung of the ladder, really, and it's very exciting.
And your work can be seen at Waddesdon Manor and online, of course. So thank you very much, Bruce Munro, for lighting up your musical choices.
Thank you very much for having me.
Bruce Munro was talking to Michael Barclay. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and the producer of today's programme was Sarah Cropper. Next week, Michael's guest is the poet Gwyneth Lewis. Hello, I'm John Shea. Welcome to this Sunday afternoon on BBC Radio 3, and just before the news, Sarah Dunant looks ahead to this evening's Sunday feature.
In April 1497, in the thriving Renaissance city of Ferrara in northern Italy, a group of scholars, doctors and humanists met in an emergency debate to discuss a new, incurable, excruciating and disfiguring sexual plague that was moving like forest fire through Europe. Syphilis, as it would be named in the 16th century poem, was to wreak havoc throughout the known world for 4.5 centuries, infecting popes and paupers, challenging public morality and highlighting the double standards between men and women. A cultural history of syphilis. This week's The Sunday Feature with me, Sarah Dunant, here on Radio 3 at 7.45.
We're off to the Lufthansa Festival of Baroque Music in a couple of minutes. That's in the early music show with Lucy Skeeping. But now on BBC Radio 3 with the time at just after 1 o'clock, here's the latest news read by David Cornett.
3 further arrests have been made in connection with the killing of an off-duty soldier near his barracks in Woolwich in South London on Wednesday. Counter-terrorism officers detained the men, who are all in their 20s, last night. 2 men who were arrested at the scene on suspicion of the murder of drummer Lee Rigby remain under armed guard in hospital. The Home Secretary, Theresa May, is facing growing calls to introduce new legislation to allow the security forces to monitor people's email and mobile phone use in the wake of the Woolwich attack. Plans for a communications data bill were dropped earlier this month after opposition from the Liberal Democrats. Detectives in France are investigating the stabbing of a soldier in Paris yesterday. The man was stabbed in the neck by an unidentified attacker while on patrol in the district of La Défense. His injuries are not life-threatening. A taxi driver and a restaurant owner, both from Nelson in Lancashire, will appear in court tomorrow, charged with endangering an aircraft. The 2 British nationals, Tayyab Subhani, who's 30, and 41-year-old Mohammed Safdar, were arrested after a plane from Pakistan to Manchester had to be diverted to Stansted on Friday. A 79-year-old man has died after being attacked by a dog outside his home in Liverpool. 2 women have been arrested. Commemorations are taking place in Liverpool to mark the 70th anniversary of the Battle of the Atlantic. Tens of thousands of men died in their efforts to keep supplies coming into Britain throughout the war. A state funeral is taking place in Serbia for the last king of Yugoslavia. Peter II, who's a second cousin of both the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh, died in the United States more than 40 years ago. The former monarch was forced to leave his country during the Second World War when the Nazis invaded. And the weather, it'll be a largely dry and bright afternoon with plenty of sunshine and feeling warm in light winds. Scotland and Northern Ireland are likely to be cloudier with a scattering of showers. A band of rain will move into northwestern parts this evening, which will spread southeastwards through the night. BBC News and Weather at 1:03.
From David Cornett. Well, the music of Wagner dominates this afternoon here on Radio 3. At 2 o'clock, we'll be hearing some of Liszt's piano transcriptions of his music, played by George Bellette and Daniel Barenboim. And that's by way of a prolonged curtain raiser to the main event, a live broadcast from the Wales Millennium Centre in Cardiff of Welsh National Opera's current production of Lohengrin. Donald MacLeod and Sarah Lenton are our hosts, and our coverage of that begins at 2:45 this afternoon. But before that, today's edition of the Early Music Show. Here's Lucy Skeeping.
It's our second visit this weekend to the Lufthansa Festival of Baroque Music from St John's Smith Square. The festival theme this year is music that represents the natural world in all its forms. And on yesterday's show, the Italian group Immaginarium included a spirited performance of Vivaldi's Four Seasons. Today, though, we're dipping into a concert that focuses on the world's greatest natural songsters. In other words, music inspired by birdsong. The performers are Ensemble La Fenice, five instrumentalists directed by Jean Toubery, who I must say is one of the most remarkable players of the cornetto I've ever heard, and I've heard quite a few in my time. We'll hear him doing his extraordinary stuff a little later on. But first, he leads the group from the recorder, and they're joined by the soprano Claire Lefiliatre in a song by Clément Jeannequin. He was one of the most popular composers of French chanson during the Renaissance, and he made a bit of a speciality of songs about nature, many as we'll hear now, using vocal noises to imitate birds. This one's all about the coming of spring, and with it, of course, love. Awake, you sleepy hearts, the god of love is calling. On this first day of May, the birds will quite amaze you. Flee regrets, tears and worries, for the season is good. Le Chant des Oiseaux, the Song of the Birds, one of Clément Jeannequin's famous chansons. The performers all through today's show are Ensemble La Fenice. And before their concert, their director Jean Toubery told us a little about the bird song-inspired music we'll be hearing next.
Clément Jeannequin was the first to go as far as possible into the imitation of these birds' sounds, using some syllables, some vowels, consonants, which didn't have any sense, and which aim was only the imitation of the bird songs. So this was quite contemporary, quite modern at this period. The second French song, or air de cour, has been composed by Étienne Moulinier. It's in a completely different style, almost two generations later. And the idea is also different. The idea that the birds are like angels on earth, who with their song and with their music speak to our hearts and our souls.
Jean Toubéry. Well, in the second piece in this next set, we're going to hear some really fantastic playing from him on the cornetto. The instrument has a trumpet-like mouthpiece, but there the similarity ends, because this is an instrument with no keys or valves, just a slightly curved wooden pipe with finger holes, which is extremely difficult to master. Nevertheless, in keeping with the style of the period, Toubéry extemporises the sort of runs, riffs and phrases that many an alto sax player today could only dream of. First, though, a song by Étienne Moulinier. It's beautiful poetry, as if the birds themselves were speaking to us. From out of our feathered bodies come voices more divine than human, which put all our troubles to sleep. Our voices work miracles, penetrating your hearts no less than your ears.